You're listening to Red Setter, your guide to digital cinema, filmmaking, and cutting-edge imaging.
Hello and welcome to this week's Red Setter. I'm Mike Seymour.
I'm Jason Wingrove. Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. We're trying slightly different technology today to improve the audio quality for our, how should I put this, selected audience that we appreciate to be very selective about how we mix this show.
Audio savvy.
Audio savvy, yes. Being camera sort of photography post guys, we're not necessarily immediately, how can I put this, competent at audio. How's your week been, Jace?
Very good. Very busy. Prepping for a couple of jobs, so
excellent.
Which is nice.
You're going up to Fiji, aren't you? Am I allowed to say that?
Yeah. Well, just I don't think I'm going to see too much of Fiji. I'm going to fly in, shoot and fly out. I think we're actually even shooting at night in a hangar. So I really won't see any in Fiji.
That was a catering company, wasn't that? Was shoot and fly through or something like that?
Eat and shoot through.
There you go. Hey, let's start by, we're going to do a quick show this week because we've got to, I've certainly got to get off and meet for a very important meeting. I'm taking my wife on a date.
Excellent.
So, right. News.
News. Okay, well, Red Rocket is the big thing. Never before has images of a video card been so slobbered over and anticipated.
If I was to bastardize a term from our good friend Stu, it's a bit like watching supermodels mud wrestles a chance to give you a back rub.
It's very sad. There's a lot of people going, oh, cool, it looks fantastic, wow.
I heard somebody actually post and say they liked the packaging. And I was a bit like, dude...
You're in Redland, really, when everyone's sort of saying, wow, awesome. It's when you sort of have unboxing porn for a video card.
I'm as red as the next guy, right? Perhaps more so than some, but I've got to say I wasn't reticularly like, you know, I mean, I'll hold on to Jim's fully metal business card with pride, but I don't need to hold on to all the packaging that my red bits and pieces come in. But having said that, we are excited by this product. We don't have one here yet, but the promise of it producing much, much higher processing of red clips is the thing that drives us all to the point of distraction.
Now, obviously, so it's obviously, even if you plug nothing into it, it's in there in the background helping with rendering, right?
It's, well, depending on the software, but yes.
Right, okay. Because obviously, just looking at it, as you do, there's what look like a couple of DVI ports, but they're actually HBHD or high bandwidth, high density ports, and each of those breaks out into two DVI ports itself. So it actually you have like sort of Y splitter cables, so you end up with four DVI cables to give you 4K. So theoretically, being play out to 4K or to quad HDMI.
Well, of course, if you think about it, if you double 2K, you double it horizontally and vertically. So
it's really
in surface
like,
area, you've gone to four times.
It's really just like stacking monitors side by side.
I think I might have mentioned this once before. That's actually how, in the early days of HD, the BBC managed to record HD. They had four D1 recorders, and every recorder recorded a quarter of the picture.
Right.
Now, think about it for a second. It was clever. And you edited the one EDL of the one tape. But because all four tapes had absolutely identical material, albeit offset by a pixel in each case, you just, once you finished your cut and standard def, you're happy with it, you went back and reconformed the other three tape machines, and then you had all four tape machines the same, then you played them all in sync, and they all recombined, and you had HD.
That makes sense.
It's very clever, I thought.
Yeah. Not at all complicated.
No, not at all complicated.
So anyway, well, obviously, we'll delve deeper into this once yours arrives, Mike, and we've had a chance to have a play with it. Yeah.
Yes.
Excellent. Do the full unboxing.
So on a local level, we've noticed that Reds are very busy.
Well, Red and or sort of digital, I've just sort of obviously been chatting to a few people lately who's, for the next two jobs I'm doing, we're actually, first of all, shooting on Red, but the decision to shoot on Red has not come from me. It's come from actually like from producers and or the budget has said so. But it's been quite hard to actually get a Red here in, I mean, they were talking about in Sydney, but I'm sure it's probably similar situations elsewhere. We've actually been quite hard to get our hands on a Red camera, and essentially, obviously not just Red, there's people are shooting F-35 and Genesis and things, but essentially, there's not a lot of film jobs going out the door, apart from, we have here in Sydney, there's an awful lot of Korean shooting goes on, a lot of sort of overseas and Asian, quite big for the Asian market, and they will come in and they'll shoot film. But essentially, apart from those clients, there's everybody else is shooting digitally, pretty much just because of, you know, budgets these days are telling us so. And we've sort of, it sort of feels like we sort of got a little bit got over the sort of post-production hump and the sort of the resistance that was out there originally. If once Red was suggested, everyone would sort of go, oh no, but the Red, you know, post is a pain. Seems like everyone's sort of got a workflow that's kind of working, and the I guess the cost of film is now starting to become the bigger issue than the post pain.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I think also, in fairness to the post companies, you know, when a new video format comes out, it takes a long time for it to be adopted. And when the new Red stuff came out, we expected the post houses to instantly be able to understand how to get the best out of it. And it wasn't as if all the equipment manufacturers had access to the SDK straight out of the gate. So in many respects, a lot of them were, you know, playing catch-up to get us something that was worthwhile. So I don't have a particular problem with that. I think it's just the expectation these days that things are instantaneous.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a little rough.
I mean, obviously, yeah. I mean, I'm not meaning to sound Red-centric, because it's not. There is an overall shift to away from film.
Well, yeah. I mean, we commented last week that 66 out of the 70 new, I think I'm right in saying that, 66 out of the new 70
TV series.
I was going to say pilots. Actually, I'm just checking my numbers. Yeah, 66 out of 70 pilots this season were shot digitally in Hollywood, and now that's for different reasons than just money or stock costs, but still it all points to the same basic issue, which is the growth of digital cinematography, which is, you know, awfully good, and we should have like a podcast about that or something.
Yeah, good idea. There's a real need for something like that.
Hey, coming up later in the show, I'm going to interview you a bit for odd reasons that'll become apparent later.
Okay.
But before we do that, we wanted to also flag some other stuff that's going around the net.
Brave man.
All right, well, I need your help.
Okay.
I'm doing a panel tomorrow.
Right,
the great part about this is I can interview you now, but the panelists won't hear this because it won't go out until after I've done that panel. So I'll get two bites of the cherry. Okay. I'll sound awfully clever at my conference. Oh, well, of course, I was talking to a director recently who said...
Yeah, because you need me to sound clever.
I do need you to sound clever. I do. Hey, so some trailers out showing Red stuff around the net, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, well, there's time for a bit of a sort of catch-up as what's coming out, because obviously we're starting to get a few more Red shows coming to the screens. Three major ones that I'm really keen to see, apart from The Girlfriend Experience by Steven Soderbergh, which isn't, I think it's almost come and gone in the States, but it's not out here yet.
Is that the one that has the porn star as the lead actress?
Yeah, yeah.
I hate that I know that that's the reason why I know that film.
Yeah, they shouldn't really have not that that's entirely negative, but you does taint,
yeah,
your,
it's a bit
taint
negative
your view
on,
of the film a bit.
Yeah.
But if she, you know, does a good performance, then great. Yes, that's what you're... I mean, that's obviously, that's the whole... But that's the whole premise of the film, is The Girlfriend Experience is like something that you buy.
Okay.
I'll fill you in later.
Not having had a girlfriend since we thought the specials were a good idea, which they are, by the way, an incredibly good idea.
But apart from The Girlfriend Experience, District 9, which I don't know too much about this film, but I think we're going to be covering this in VFX show coming up soon. It's primarily shot on Red and shot in New Zealand, I think, for Wingnut Films, mm-hmm. Peter Jackson's company.
So it started out as a short, right?
Right.
And then it was made into a feature. And, we'll be talking about more that when it comes out, but it's available on Apple Movie Trailers.
Yep, indeed.
Coming out mid-August.
Yeah, District 9. So we'll put links to all of these in the show notes, but you can obviously just search it on apple.com/trailers, I think.
Yeah, go on.
The Informant, another Soderbergh picture, The Man Does Not Sleep, I swear, which is actually sort of a quirky comedy with Matt Damon, which is looks great, and I just applaud him for his ability to crank out interesting work and to not just direct it, but direct and shoot at the same time, and also crack out.
I'm staggered by people that can do that
and do really great creative work and be concentrating on fantastic performances like he does.
But you know, he works with such great actors as well. I mean, Matt Damon is just such a delight to watch on the screen in anything he does.
Yeah, it makes it all the easier when the guys can just walk on camera and just do their bit, and it's gold from take one. But still, nonetheless, you still got to do it. You got to schedule it. You got to recce it.
Totally.
You got to shoot it. Expose it. So
there's just too much for me to think about. I mean, and I don't mean that like in a silly sense. I mean, literally, I can't concentrate two or three things at once. And I don't mean that in a childish way. Good. It's just very hard to be thinking.
It's a man thing.
Is this going to I believe that Stephen is a man. Isn't this going to composite together well? Isn't this going to edit together well? Isn't this going to cut well? Isn't the lighting right? And then be worrying about, I think the delivery is foreboding what will be coming in the third act.
Yeah. I think it's that the joy, delighting in that little bit of fear of the unknown. You know, if it's a little bit underexposed, well, cool. Well, that's so be it. You know, we'll just get. I'm sure if you've got great, that's why he totally surrounds himself in fantastic actors. They're obviously looking after themselves in their sort of performances and their sort of character arc, and they're sort of, I guess they're kind of, you know, looking. To some degree, after the sort of acting department, he can look after everything else, I think. What do I know?
When you're directing somebody, and I ask this as a serious question, when you're directing somebody, do you feel like a lot of that direction happens in the discussions you have before the camera rolls? Because you've kind of established where they're coming from and what's going on and where we are.
Yeah.
And then you hand it over to them to collaboratively.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, by the time you roll, even on a commercial, by the time you roll, really, you've done a casting and you've done a recall to double check the casting, and everyone kind of knows that it's right. And of course you choose the person that fits the role right in the first place, so it's kind of, they're almost in character when they arrive because you sort of cast it that way, you know what I mean?
And yet when you look at some of the great performances of some Australian actors who have done things, and I'm thinking now of an actor who was in both a it was in TV comedy. Then he goes on to do an incredibly tough guy portraying an indie Australian filmer. Basically, the guy's alive today, so I should be careful how I say this. A very well-respected murderer.
A Klingon.
And then a Klingon, yes. I'm speaking, of course, of Eric Banner. Now, Eric Banner is like a stand-up comedian, yet, I mean, how do you cast him as the tough guy in Black Hawk Down?
He's very, very adaptable. So I guess that's the kind of thing where you sort of really, they can play it any way you like, and you have to, that's what rehearsals are for, I guess, work out what is the character, you know.
One of the things that fascinates me is when an actor stays in character between setups.
Yeah, I mean, some guys can just literally be telling a joke and just rapping with you until literally someone says action, and then bang, they're into character. And other guys who are just totally intense method people will just literally, if they're meant to be unlikable, they'll stay unlikable. Right, you know, even between takes at lunchtime, you won't get anything.
Platoon with Oliver Stone, he actually kept the two actors apart because was that Michael J. Fox and Sean Penn? Well, they were in something else. Anyway, I think it was those two actors were in a film, and the director, I remember, kept them apart so they would never connect as people.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he didn't want the other on screen. But, I'm going to go and see Bruno tonight, right? Which we know, joke away. But now, having said that, go back to the previous film, right?
Yeah.
And he apparently stayed in character even when the police were pulling them over.
Yeah, right.
He immersed himself in that part, and whether you think it's outrageous comedy or just stupidity.
Oh, I think he's an astounding actor to do what he does and do it on the cuff, and more importantly, to not break up.
If you're Barat, you're playing Barat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is Naz, and then you manage to stay in character between takes. I mean, that's like an astonishing commitment to the craft, isn't it?
Yeah. That's probably the only way. I mean, if it was me, I'm not an actor, but that would probably be the only way I would actually be able to not
lose it.
Not lose it, yeah. Because if you're in character, you wouldn't. You know, if you turn yourself into Borat, then yeah, you're probably not gonna lose it, because the only people laughing are everybody else. I guess.
Well, of course, at the time that he's giving the presentation, the only humour is evident to him, if that makes sense. I mean, if he is in a situation trying to whatever he's done,
that's how he gets away with it, because no one knows he's under the radar.
Some of it is staged, right? Like Pamela Anderson was in on it, obviously.
Definitely.
But nevertheless, there are a lot of people that aren't in on it. Hence the lawsuits.
Yeah, I mean, same the second time around. Looks like there's a little bit more set up. So I'll be keen to see.
We're keen to see
what you think.
Hey, changing the subject back to what we're talking about.
Yep.
Apparently, I can trade our Red in for $30,000.
Can I go back one more trailer?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. Directed by and DP'd by Peter Hyams, who is like a god, I reckon. 2010, the awesome Outland. Loved Outland. Time Cop.
Is that Outland with Sean?
With Sean Connery.
Can I tell you a funny thing?
Cop, Capricorn 1, Presidio.
Can I tell you a funny thing?
Go.
You know, in Outlander, Sean was in the future and he wore a spacesuit.
Right.
Yes. We were on the set of Red Dwarf dressing it.
Yeah.
And we got stuff out of the props department and we put a helmet down. And the director picked it up because, you know, no one else would pick up a prop because, you know, you obviously don't pick up props and muck around with them.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you're the director, you're allowed to do that.
Sure.
And Doug picked it up and he was looking at it and he said, oh, check this out. And inside was a piece of thing stuck on it and it had Connery written on it.
Excellent.
No one had actually taken and used it since, obviously.
The helmet from Outland.
Yeah.
Awesome.
I wanted to nick it. I wanted to sell it on eBay.
Absolutely.
Could have funded my whole trip.
Oh, dear.
Anyway, sorry. So, yes.
I'm really anticipating that one. That looks great. That's fantastic that Peter's still out there kicking some goals. So, and he sounds like he's a fan
Does
of...
Does the film look like it'll be good?
A fan, yeah.
What's the genre?
Oh, sort of thriller.
Thriller?
Essentially. But,
unreasonable. That sounds like a law thriller, doesn't it?
But I think the last thing he shot before and the next thing that he's got slated are all red. So it sounds like he's a bit of a fan, which is cool.
It's funny, isn't it, how important the name of a film is? I'm just looking at those three films, District 9, Beyond Reasonable Doubt and The Informant. Two of those I can tell you pretty much exactly what they're going to be. And the third one I could make an educated guess.
Mm, District 9, that's a bit of a grey one. But... But yeah, so it's
so I was about to say.
You were about to say.
For a gag. I can trade in my red for $30,000 off a new P2 Vericam.
Awesome, because that's the future.
Two-thirds inch.
Yeah. Are you going to do that?
I am not.
No.
I am not going to take up an offer that expires on the September 30th. I'm not going to trade in my large red sensor for a two-thirds inch. I'm not going to get an AJH. PX3700. And look, I have B2 cameras. I'm not.
But the camera's worth $60,000. You can get it for $29,000.
Okay. Moving on.
Okay.
You showed me, and I think it's brilliant, and we can put it in the show notes.
Again,
amazing
for humour value only.
Tell us about it.
It's a clip which was done here in Australia on, I think it was, I'm trying to think the film they shot it on, was Van Diemen's Land, maybe? A film shot on red. It's called Subtleties of the Slate.
Subtleties of the Slate.
It's about the subtleties of slating, about being the clapper loader. It's about the art behind the seemingly mundane act of operating the clapper board, and obviously, and gives some if you have to, you know, operate a slate for a living, or even if you don't, it's a insight into the art and craft of doing it, and some fantastic techniques: the ninja, the tippy toe, the reveal. The single serve, forehand and backhand single serve.
I must say the ninja is my favourite.
Yeah, so it is hysterical. So links to the show notes, or you can go onto Vimeo and search for Subtleties of the Slate.
It has the characteristic hallmark of you watch it and you go, I wish I'd thought of that.
Yeah, it's beautifully done. And yeah, I've learned something.
You have, which is surprising, really. Hey, I don't know why you put this in the notes, so I want to move on, but
okay.
I'm going to... Indulge you.
It's the silly episode.
No, it's not the silly episode. It's just you're being like.
I know this is encouraging him.
You are.
Dan Sturm, who did the 3D iPhone rig, is at it again. He's got now handheld iPhone
shoulder mount
3D rig, which
with
is
a giant microphone,
a highly discreet audio option on the top there, and the anaglyph monitor on the back. Massive monitor. I don't know where you power this thing. You're going to need to tow along a little Honda Jenny and a little flyer.
I get good battery life from my iPhones. I don't know what you're talking about. Anyway,
so that's definitely worth a look. A few pics there on Red User for handheld.
Now,
iPhone 3D.
Now, I want to get to my interview today, which I want to have with you.
Which is me.
Which is you. And I'll tell you why
we're in a stupid mood.
No, I'm not in a stupid mood. I'm in a really serious mood. I have a serious problem. Tomorrow, I'm going to be presenting a panel. I'm not actually speaking per se. I guess I'm introducing a panel at the SMPTE conference in Australia. So there's a conference that's happening, which is the SMPTE conference. Unlike SMPTE in, say, I don't know, North America, SMPTE here acts pretty much like an NAB, and it's the primary.
Yeah, it's our NAB, isn't it?
And at that, there's a subsection run by the Australian Cinematographer Society, who we love to death, and they asked me to be a host of a panel discussing stuff to do with the emerging nature of stuff. In fact, I actually came to me initially over stuff to do more with the current. And I said, well, let's look at future digital acquisition, I said. Wouldn't it be interesting, I said, to talk about what's coming down the pipe and where we are and where this merging of stills and new digital technologies and stuff. And everyone went, yeah, that's a great idea, Mike.
Excellent.
Now I am here the night before the presentation, and I want to get your take on this. And I think it's an interesting take. Unfortunately, I can't record the session tomorrow for you guys. If I can get a recording of it, we'll post it as a bonus thing. But I think a lot of the questions raised in this are particularly relevant. Now, let me give you some background. The team at FXPhD has just been in Japan, where we were filming for the new DOP course in the July term of FXPhD, and we were shooting with the Canon 5D Mark II as well as some other stills cameras. Now, I've shown Jason a clip from that, and
it looks fantastic.
It does look good, and it just brought up a whole lot of issues. But the number one issue that I thought was kind of interesting, I guess, is particularly relevant to this podcast, which is just in light of how successful the 5D is suddenly, you know, been and how it's taken off and how things are kind of exploding, how that kind of impacts on the whole issue of Red Scarlet, which is coming now. We know from a video released out of Germany in the next couple of months.
Next couple of months, yeah.
And well, so I was about to do that, and then you posted saying that you'd actually been shooting with the 5D on the weekend.
Yeah, I'd sort of been avoiding the sort of Voldemort of cameras, the camera that should not be named, until I did sort of promise that I wouldn't really talk about it until it sort of got rid of the 24 or 25 issue, or that was sort of rectified in some way.
The stuff we were shooting, at 34, 24 playback because we wanted the, which you normally do, right? You take the edge off, you shoot.
Yeah, well, that's exactly kind of what I'm planning for. I mean, what this little shoot in Fiji, I'm going to, because we literally have so little time to shoot it, it just, we're sort of shooting on a plane while it's literally on the in a hangar for service, and we've got only just a few hours to shoot a commercial on board. So I sort of suggested it as a little bonus. I wasn't really going to sort of rely on it. If it died, you know, if it quit on us, I wasn't going to be stitched up. I just thought it'll be an extra sort of B-roll sort of stuff, a few extra little shots to cut in, and if we do get under the thumb, then we'll use it as officially as like second unit. And because we're not shooting dialogue, and because I would be on the main unit, which will be the Red, slightly overcranking anyway, I thought fine, that'll work. And so I just went out for a recce at the airport, and just the plane was delayed, so I just sat at the airport bar and just had the 70 to 200 and just sat there filming people coming and going. Just sat there, people sort of, you know, the kisses and goodbyes and hugs, and where we were sitting there having our meal waiting for the plane, just happened to be there by departures, and I was just watching people. And I was just, it's incredibly immersive, and I just thought, oh, this is sort of something big, really. It just was so, what made it interesting that it's so easy. With such shallow depth of field, it's so easy to get really nice image. You don't have to sort of try that hard to get imagery looking really interesting and filmic. And the other thing was, I mean, I was just sort of essentially spying on people who are, you know, saying goodbye and crying with loved ones. And no one really, apart from one person who just looked up and then looked away again, no one felt intimidated. No one was obviously looking at me the whole time, because I really just looked like, I mean, you're not looking at the viewfinder with the 5D. You're looking at the back. It's like you look like you're just looking back at shots from, you know, you've already shot. Okay. So you feel discreet.
Absolutely, but that begs the question, though, right? Scarlet wise,
it's a long answer to a question.
Yeah, but I mean, I mean, I think we're comfortable with the 5D, and we've discussed it in the past. But what I want to hit on really hard is this question of how the 5D relates to Scarlet, because. Actually, it was a question my business partner asked Stu the other day, and I actually have Stu's answer. I'm sure he won't mind me reading it. But what is your opinion? I mean, is it less interesting to you to get a...
Yes. Two-thirds?
Yeah.
Yeah. Sadly, yes. I mean, this is... When you just play with something for 5 minutes, and I was just blown away. I all of a sudden felt incredibly creative playing with this thing. Not that I probably wouldn't with something two-thirds, you know, a two-thirds inch chip, but it feels like I'm just seeing so much footage now of full frame 35. It feels like full frame 35 is the new 35, you know. So if you can get that kind of quality, then yeah, it's going to be really hard sell. Two-thirds inch is really sort of, I mean, obviously the pluses are going to be the fact that you can overcrank. You can shoot, obviously, the amount of control you're going to have raw, you're going to have you're going to have just massive control. So I think it's going to have its pluses, but it's going to be, yeah. I mean, I think if I had the choice, if a 5D had 25 frames or 24 frames, then it would be a no-brainer. The compression that's there, to me, is not enough of a downer to go for something raw in two-thirds, to me.
Well, that's where we kind of diverge, because I think that the... Let me read Stu's response to a similar question that I'm sure he doesn't mind me reading. Basically, he came back with saying he thinks Red's going to have a really hard time selling an FF35, in other words, a full-frame 35 camera body, for less than 3K, which, let's face it, is what...
Yeah.
Now, the 5D right now doesn't do 24p, so it's not as if we're claiming the Canon 5D is perfect. But he also points out he thinks Canon's going to have a pretty hard time creating their own lightly compressed raw video codec and format.
Mm.
And I guess I would add to that I think that, and I've said this for a while now, we haven't seen any auto-focusing technology from Red, but we've never seen any really good post-production formats and color space stuff in video from Canon.
Yeah.
Because for me, the thing that makes the Canon 5D Mark II interesting is its size, the interchangeable lenses, because they're quality lenses.
Yep.
Obviously, the cost, let's not deny it.
Yep.
But also that whole access to areas not noticed as a video camera.
Yeah. Which the Scarlett still would buy you to a certain degree.
To a certain extent. Once you hit Epic, you're probably not. But, I mean, literally, like a DSLR doesn't raise an eyebrow. A DSLR. Did I not say it again? I'm sorry. DSLR.
It's all right.
I have the lisp. I have been saying DLSR around the office this week. DSLR. Okay, so let me ask you a couple of these questions I'm going to ask the panel tomorrow. Firstly, do you reckon that something like a Canon, that's not saying to be Canon, it could be Nikon, but a Canon premium lens, like say the 70 to 200, which I think is what you were using on the weekend, is that good enough to shoot a TVC, a commercial?
Yeah, I mean, the lenses are. I don't know. See, I can slip the 5D into a set because it's sort of, you know, it's like bonus. It's like extra B-roll. It's, you know, it's not the main camera. On a commercial, even a small one, the whole set revolves around Video Village and revolves around the powers that be being able to see something on a monitor.
Ah, so now you're going for the real gotchas of the 5D.
There's definitely some gotchas. If it's going to be your A-cam, if you're going to shoot it.
And that's the lack of...
It's a lack of a video out. I mean, also, as an operator, you need to have an option other than just sticking a little Velcro, a loop on the back of an LCD monitor. It's impossible to see focus. And it's, I'm not sure what the video out is on the 5D, but it's pretty screwed up. It's, you've got obviously menus on there, and it's not full HD. I believe there really isn't a solution there for monitoring. So that is obviously going to be a major, you know, plus for something like the Scarlett.
Does the weird audio bug you?
For a reasonable commercial, most of the time you're going to be shooting double system. You know, you're going to have a sound recordist, and you're going to, sync it, or you'll just sort of sync it up later, or do slates. So the audio isn't so much of an issue, I think.
Okay, so let me ask you this, which is the more fundamental question, I guess. Does it bug you that it's only 1920 by 1080?
Yeah, well, there's so much that I'm willing to forgive because of the full frame 35. You know, I mean, I am seeing a little bit of Jell-O cam. I'm seeing a little bit of rolling shutter artifacts. People were firing off, you know, because people are taking happy snaps of people to say, you know, say goodbye. And obviously you can clearly see that the CMOS issues where you only see the flash from the camera in the top half of the frame, or just a little tiny line of flash. You never really, you know, little things like that. If you move the camera too rapidly, you definitely do get a bit of Jell-O cam. There's definitely.
Let me shift gears then for a second and say, when Red announced the Scarlett and the Epic, which, you know, we were first in line, as it were, to check out electronically online when the announcement was made.
Yeah.
That was pre-major economic meltdown crisis.
Absolutely.
So my question to you now is...
And pre-5D.
But my question to you now is, with the concept of moving to 5K, 6K and 9K, do we think, and I'm going to try this from a lens point of view, do we think there's some real damage to its adoption based on the fact that the Red 1 was a PL mount, so we could use all our current lenses we had lying around.
Yeah,
sure. And obviously the Epic X will still be the PL mount. Mm. But things like the Epic 645 and 617 are going to have actually bigger sensors. They're going to require different lenses.
Yeah, you're getting into stills lens areas there. You're going to have like the Mamiya medium format lenses for the 645, and you're going to have some very...
But you told me once before that if the 645 came out, you'd buy it in a heartbeat or get it in a heartbeat.
Oh, definitely. Absolutely.
But you don't think it's going to be a problem about lenses?
Well, I mean, what you're going to find is going to be, which is what's happening now with, and I'll touch on this in the gear section on what, a lens I'm looking at. You're going to find a lot of, there's going to be an absolute boon to the industry of people wanting to rehouse medium format, like stills lenses, and rehouse them, put correct follow focus gears on them.
You're talking about like Hasselblad kind of lenses or?
Yeah, medium format, Mamiya 645, medium format lenses.
Okay.
Of which there's
like 6x7 medium format thingies.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Bronica, that sort of Mamiya 6.7. Everyone is going to be clamoring over those lenses, adapting them, putting correct follow focus gears on them, making the focus go the correct direction. Adapting all that sort of medium format, and those lenses are just outstanding. You know, they're designed to be their imagery to be blown up to huge, massive, billboards. So
yeah, I mean, I'm less interested in the 617 than the 645.
Yeah,
the 645 I think is a particularly interesting camera. Yeah. I personally have no hesitation in wanting to buy an Epic X. I mean, the second that they let me swap that Red for an Epic X, I'm there.
Yeah.
But I'm a big believer in shooting with PL mount lenses because there are so many of them lying around, as it were.
Yeah.
Availability.
Absolutely. So much glass. I mean, obviously, everybody who has a Red has an investment in most people have an investment of some kind in red PL glass or third party glass.
But I've got to say, the camera I want to buy several of would be Scarlets that just take Canon mount lenses.
Yeah.
Like right after I get an Epic X, which is my first thing, the second thing I'd like is a bunch of Scarlets that take Canon lenses. Thanks very much.
What chip?
Oh, I'd like something bigger than a 2/3 inch, but I would be happy with the S35.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm not being dirty on the regular 35 depth. That's been what we've been trying to achieve along. But I just sort of now sort of visually spoiled. I'm seeing such a difference in the footage of the 5D. Almost willing to look over all of this sort of CMOS artifacts and it doesn't do 25 and the crappy sound and terrible monitoring, no video outs.
I want difference between the Scarlet and the Epic, right? I see the Epic X as being really interesting. I think the full frame 35 Epic also is really interesting.
Yeah, definitely.
But if somebody wants a cheap job, I want to have a cheaper camera that takes good lenses that you can put in that job.
That is a continuing problem, obviously. Everybody who wants to rent a Red, I mean, for rental companies, it's a real issue because they've got kits and kits and kits of Master Primes and Cook S4s. Every single lens costs more than a Red.
Yeah. And
just
also,
to buy.
If you go and buy a really cool 645, the first thing, I think you said this yourself, I'm quoting you, back to you, is they're going to walk in and say, I want it, but for the price of a Epic X, thanks.
Yeah.
And you go, but it's different. And they'll go, well, they're both Epics.
Yeah. But also, but what is happening is that everybody who rents a Red, they want, it's all about getting the job for cheap. It's about everyone wants the package for cheap. They want the great lenses. When they want to rent a lens or want to rent all their lenses for the same price as their body, and a set of lenses cost five times the price of the... It used to be the other way around. For our E3 you didn't even question it, or an 435, whatever, you're talking couple of $100,000. Lenses that cost 80 was nothing. That was the cheap bit. Now we're getting to a stage where the glass that's in front of the camera costs five times the price of the camera. But for rental companies, there's just going to be this real issue they've got. No one's going to want to pay the money.
Okay, let me ask you another two quick questions. One is, is 100 frames enough? I mean, 100 frames a second enough?
No, absolutely. Well, I mean, the most film cameras just off the shelf, the high speed stuff is like 120 frames a second. I think so. I mean, what I don't want to see is just this, once everybody can get a Scarlett that does 180 frames a second or so, I just don't want to see this dearth of every second commercial is super slow-mo because we can, you know. So, 100 frames, yeah, is outstanding, let alone 180. I mean, most of the time, the funny thing about slow motion, we've talked about this before, is that it's always slower looking back at it than you think it's going to be. You know, 50 frames is always, you think, 50 frames, that's not very fast.
30,
go 75, and then you look at it and you go, oh, gee, I can't even get the scissors in there to cut that shot. It takes so long. I should have shot it at 30. You know, so you always sort of, you know, if whatever speed you think you should shoot at, shoot one at that speed, but then shoot one just that little bit sort of, you know, go just back it off a little bit.
I once worked with a director who used to finish every commercial at 31 seconds or 30 plus seconds. Yeah, 30 seconds and 17 frames, and they just couldn't for the life of them ever get it down to 30 seconds. So you had to take the whole bloody clip and speed it up and then try and hide where the speed
looks
so
horrible.
Couldn't tell.
And then it looked awful. Looks like a video.
Hey,
So I've really answered I've answered every one of your questions in an incredibly roundabout way.
Another question. Let's talk about the Genesis for a second, right? The Genesis is hugely successful. The Genesis is by far one of the most dominant cameras for use in episodic television. My question to you is, what do we want out of, say, a Genesis Mark II? What's the thing that we most want to see in the Genesis that we don't see now?
Well, probably better than 1080p resolution.
So
I think it can overcrank at the moment, can't it?
What would make Genesis II sexy to you is being able to shoot higher res than...
Yeah, than being able to... I mean, obviously... Most of the time when we're shooting for TV commercials here, we're essentially most of the stuff, and I'm sure it's the same in the States, most of it's going out standard def. So in terms for talking from a, you know, from a TV commercial point of view, it's obviously the resolution is more than enough, and we can blow up and push in and tighten quite easily without running out of resolution. But this has got to be this has got to be pushing some boundaries to be shooting something for a cinema release and going to a 2K DI from something that is a 1080p camera original. That can't be good maths.
So what do you want most that is in the Genesis that you don't have in other cameras? Because I can answer that one. For me it's just...
Well, why the Genesis is really popular, and the F23 and the Sony F35, is this. It is considered to be a really smooth, simple, time proven workflow because you can go to the SR HD tapes. Yeah, that's what the tapes called, isn't it? Yeah,
SR tapes. Yeah.
HDSR. Thank you. Yeah, that's considered to be a real slot straight into existing workflow. Everybody knows what they're doing, even though the tapes are horrendously expensive and it's real-time ingestion, you know, all the things that shooting to a data camera isn't. But it is, for that, it's really accepted, and that's what gets it across the line from a production point of view. The RED workflow is still considered to be, even though it's not really a case, the anecdotal sort of, you know, opinion out there, I guess, from producers and people who finally make these final decisions money-wise, whether you go RED or you go Genesis, is that RED is a pain and that, you know, it's not cost-effective and it's false economy. Yeah, I mean, that's what is great about the Genesis, is, you know, this simple... accepted workflow. But
I mean, there's a big difference. Like, let's take somewhere out of LA for a second, right? There's a big difference between a camera rental company approach on some of those bigger cameras than you can on the RED, because to a certain extent there's more money in the deal. You know what I mean? Like, for example, if you're selling a camera that is worth $3,000, you can't afford to have a highly trained technician that'll spend a day with you in a test bay going through all the camera and going through all the settings with you. I mean, just I'm not having a go at Panavision. Yeah. I'm not having a go at Red. I'm just saying. It just doesn't make sense. And then at the other end of the spectrum, if you've got a kit that's going out on a big feature that's costing, you know, a lot of money, and it's $250,000 camera, or an F, I don't know what an F-35 is clocking in at, but it's got to be a fair bit. Well, it jolly well is cost-effective to have someone sit there and hand-hold you and do stuff, because it all filters through to the economics. And even though we say that Reds are, you know, in scarce supply for rental, they're still not renting out at the rate comparable to what you'd rent out an F-35 at in a pink fit.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I guess the other thing for in Genesis is...
I mean, it's an evil backhand, isn't it? You have a you have a cheaper camera, which may be great for a producer, but from a cinematographer's point of view, he still has to get the pictures, and he's now no longer allowed to have the luxury of having the kind of backup and support that we are typically used to. And I can't imagine a service contract going out with the camera, like, we'll sell you a Red, but give you the support and service that you're used to with.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is that. Obviously, it is. It also is seen as pretty... The Genesis is seen as absolutely bulletproof, you know, proven... You know, strap it to anything you like, kind of technology, and the Red just isn't seen that way. It's almost seen like, you know, you need to have, whenever you're renting a Red, it's, you know, the perception is, I need to make sure, where's that backup body? Who's got one that's not working that day? Are they, you know, are they going out for the day, or are they going to be able to be, you know, can they jump in their car in 15 minutes if I have a problem? You know, you almost need to, for every Red as a rental company, you know, you need to make sure there's one sort of standing by on the shelf back at the, you know.
But doesn't it seem a bit like the backup and support strategy some companies offer, not having got anyone in particular, but some companies, their whole support strategy is there's a spare body. That's it.
Yeah. Well, that, I mean, I guess, you do have to have that sort of situation for film, I suppose. Yeah, never having run a rental house, I don't know, but I'm sure they do still have to have backups. But it's definitely perceived to be unreliable, which is, you know, unfortunately, you only need one bad story and that can just spread like wildfire and create, you know, virtual five bad stories out there. You know, you need one camera overheating out of 50 shoots to make it sound like they all overheat.
To a certain extent, the thing that worked most in Red's favour was its community, right? So even though that is true to an extent, like the community got behind the camera and basically sucked it up even when it didn't work 100%.
Yeah, well, that's something that's helped propel it to punch above its weight, I guess. It's something that's helped to propel it to shoot beyond its, you know, it was sort of, its roots are in this indie kind of, you know, the indie kind of mentality. You know, this is like big quality for the masses, you know, for the little guy, this is for film quality for the DigiBeta budget. So, and what the problem has been is that everybody else has leapt on it as well, and the people who would normally have shot Genesis or shot film have gone onto it and dragged it kicking and screaming up into the really pro away from the sort of indie market, and that's been the issue. The, you know, trying to make it do something that it wasn't ready for prime time for. That's not an anti-Red thing. What's the fantastic thing about Red has been that it's almost... Everybody was really happy to be the beta site. Everyone was happy to sort of be help the developing process along. But the problem, that has been the problem as well, that the you're dragging a beta site onto a major film set, and when it doesn't, you know, when it plays up, or, you know, doesn't play the game, then, you know, there's heads roll, you know.
I mean, it's my perception that Red has changed its attitude a bit, and it's a bit more like, we're going to talk about stuff when we have stuff to show, more than just talking about stuff when we...
Yeah, definitely. And obviously...
Because I think there have been some structural changes that they just haven't announced, because they thought that after the other two announcements...
Yeah,
they jumped the shark almost,
and I'm sure, obviously, they've learned in the way to roll things out. You know once, you know, Scarlett and all those things are sort of going to be propelled en masse out there, the numbers out there are going to be massive. That they just can't do the kind of quality control and recall issues, and part of that whole beta site thing, they'll have to do a lot more of that internally and get it really sorted before it gets out there, because you just can't recall, you know, 30,000 cameras, you know, just like that. It's just not going to be cost effective.
Absolutely. But even at the outset of Red, we knew that this was a company built by people that had experience in large scale consumer distributed products. They, I mean, you know, of any company, these guys knew how to make things en masse with high quality control. This is not a company that's growing and having, I think they always knew that when they got to the quote soccer mom camera, then they'd have to be changing that. But then they were very prepared to do that because they were just used to doing it with, you know, high quality optic glasses and all sorts of things.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's just one of those things. It just was this massive groundswell that kind of pushed it faster than it could run. You know what I mean? It was like running down a hill. Gravity is dragging you faster than your legs can take you. It's kind of like the whole success of it has been its own worst enemy, really.
Well, you've given me
good and bad.
You've given me lots of food to thought for the presentation tomorrow. Thank you. Actually, just a funny thing on that video we saw of Ted in Germany with the the one post that I loved the most on Twitter was, "Mike, we're going to need a bigger soccer mum." Hey,
that was great.
So you had some gear stuff to finish up the week?
Yeah, look, this I guess is touching on with the whole lenses thing I was talking about. Our friends, Matt at Duclos Lenses, have essentially taken what is a fantastic the original stock stills lens, the Takina 11-16mm lens, a T28 lens, and rehoused it and obviously, you know, made it a bit more bulletproof, put proper follow focus gears on it, taken the little detents off the little click stops off the iris out, reversed the focus cam. So obviously once you put it on a camera with a follow focus, the follow focus goes the correct direction for your your camera assistant's not going to be pulling the focus in the correct in the opposite direction to how he's learnt for the last 5 years. Obviously, you know, bulletproofed the thing and rehoused it, and so they have this fantastic lens which is now really sort of been cineized, I guess you'd call it. And it's like $3,000. It's fantastic.
Is it $3,000 for the lens, or $3,000 if I give you a lens and you mod it for me?
If you've got if you already own a Takina 11-16mm, they will rehouse it for $2,500, I think. But essentially,
so I can just buy one for $3,000, full stop, walk in the door.
Well, obviously you have to go on the waiting list because this has proved to be a really popular, and this is this groundswell, I think, in this glass. People want, you know, glass they can afford to own rather than rent. And there is this sort of, I mean, obviously, it's like everything. Everything is getting better and everything, you know, glass is getting better. And what you can buy with, you know, with the Red Primes and the, I think, the Q Optics Primes, everyone's coming out with glass that is far cheaper and almost as good as, you know, lenses that are essentially, you know, $20,000 a pop for one single prime. So, you know, that's part of the revolution is that the cameras have got cheaper and now glass is kind of catching up and people are adapting and, you know, life is finding a way here. So yes.
Well, I think life's going to find a way big time in the next couple of months as we start to see stuff rolling out from Red. And also, I have heard rumours on the internet of some 24p action at one of the major stills companies also in the same time frame. So
right.
I think there's going to be movement in them there hills.
Yeah. So anyway, Duclos lenses, 11. That's a fantastic range, 11mm to 16mm. And obviously, traditionally, those kind of lenses, the wider you go, the more precision you can't. There's no room for, you know, mechanical error. That you've got to. These lenses have to be built right. It's all the more critical to build a wide angle lens than it is to build a tight. You can get away with a lot more. So I just think that's a fantastic set. The first batch is pre-sold, but the second batch you can get in there and pre-order it, and that's about 6 to 8 weeks for delivery for that. So yeah, I'm more than happy to support these guys. They're doing a fantastic job. Good on you. So
we have to finish it up there because I'm going to miss out on my date.
Yes.
And I haven't been married very long, so it's a hot date. I've only been married for coming up on 19 years.
Okay.
Hey, Jace, great seeing you again, sir.
Thanks, mate.
And
see you soon.
Jace is actually not only in his normal places, such as his website, Jason Wingrove. Is it Wingrove or Jason Wingrove?
JasonWingrove.com.
And on the Twitters.
At Wingrove.
But he's actually helping out in fxphd.com this term and doing some stuff for a short film that we'll be talking more about in coming weeks that we'll be filming after I get back from SIDGRAPH in Yawns.
Mm-hmm.
And but we're very, very keen to see or watch you direct up close and personal like.
I'm keen to get in there and do it. Keen to do something beyond 30 seconds.
I have to say that the number one reason we were keen to get Jace to direct, apart from the fact that he's a nice guy, is that we wanted somebody that was going to be really good at performance and sort of storytelling direction and not what we already think we've got sort of under control, which is sort of the technical side of things. Mm. So I'm certainly looking forward to, is it a learning experience? I actually just want to learn how you work with talent and also just how you work with the crew in that sort of, I can handle technical stuff, not a problem, but I'm really looking forward to seeing how you weave your craft, as it were.
Thank you.
Because normally I don't talk to Jace on set because I, like, you know, I'm a lowly VFX supervisor and he's a big note director and I don't want to distract him and there are all these agency people around him and people giving him peeled grapes and things. But on this set, I'll be able to interrupt him. Why'd you do that, Jace?
You can peel my grapes.
Oh, thanks, mate. I appreciate it. Until next time, guys, thank you so much for listening.
Thanks, guys.
See ya.
See ya.
Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments, please email us red@fxguide.com. Copyright 2009, FX Guide, LLC.